Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Conversation Season 5. Once again, we'll start off by respectfully acknowledging that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkrepik people, and that fairly resolving this situation still is and always will be an ongoing responsibility for us all. Today we have two guests who are well-known to listeners to Food Conversations and well-known in the food community of Salmon Arm and the Shuswap. They are Serena Kaner, known to many people as the president of the Shuswap Food Action Society, but now the executive director of that organization, and as well the society's hardworking project coordinator. Some people may know her as the secretary, but she's the project coordinator now, Melanie Bennett. Today, they're here to update us on the activities of the Food Action Society and especially to introduce the 2023 edition of the Coldest Night of the Year event, the Society's principal fundraising event of the year. Melanie and Serena, welcome again to Food Conversations.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you on the show again. I'll remind listeners that Melanie approached the station at one point and said, what about translating the in-person Food Conversations up at the college into a radio version, and we flew with that idea, and it's still going and growing. Now, before we get into some of the new developments that are part of the Society's work, let's begin with a brief mention of the date, time, and location of the Coldest Night of the Year event, and we'll get back to the details later on. So, Melanie, could you just lay out those basic parameters about the Coldest Night of the Year event?
Yes, it is Saturday, February 25th, and it's a late afternoon event. So check-in starts from 4 o'clock till 5 at downtown Saskew, where we all gather together and we'll have treats and warm drinks. We get together, we have our opening ceremonies, and then we do our walks as a community. There's a 2-kilometer and a 5-kilometer route that you can choose when you register to walk. And we do this really nice walk that has a lot of meaning to us. We make our way and we have a rest stop where there's more treats and drinks. And we make our way down to downtown Askew's, where we will be serving stone soup and local buns and locally made treats. And then we get together and we give each other a lot of high fives and camaraderie. And we love this because it's really good for community building.
And along the way, there are a lot of interesting conversations that take place. Serena, do you find that that chance for people to talk to one another and share sort of values and beliefs about the way community should work, that really gets encouraged by this format?
Absolutely. You know, our big mandate is to build community around local food. And, you know, this event, that's exactly what it's doing. Last year was great because we had an in-person event and it was, you know, after COVID. And so people hadn't really been gathering. And so to share soup outside, you know, it almost felt like a party because people were just so excited to actually be around other people again.
I think I was getting a little embarrassed when I came back last year for my third cup of that soup. But I tried to do it sort of surreptitiously so nobody noticed that I was chowing down so much. Okay, let's talk about some of the new things that the Society is doing, because there's an ongoing process and evolutionary change and expansion of the kinds of things you're doing. One important part is education and teaching. Let's talk a little bit about work with the District PAC, Parent Advisory Council, and there's an event coming up on February the 18th, a stone soup event. Serena, could you kind of outline that?
Absolutely. So for listeners who aren't aware, stone soup is a story. And it's a story that has many cultural variations. You know, in fact, I'm sure every culture has their own version of this story. But basically, it's about these two hungry people who show up to a community. And at first, everyone is really skeptical and they don't understand, you know, what these people are, what they want. And when they ask for food, no one offers anything. And so they're like, well, we'll make some soup out of stones. And so they get this pot and they build a fire and then they put some water in the pot with stones. And then suddenly all these people come out of the woodwork and they're like, oh, well, you know what would be good in that with those in that soup? Or I found these carrots. And then, oh, and I found these onions. And soon the whole village is gathered and everyone has donated something to put in the soup. And then at the end, they all eat and share and have a great time together. And so it's sort of about how, you know, it's about collective impact and how every individual has a role to play and how people work better in groups. You know, we need to work in groups and because then you get more than the sum of its parts.
For sure.
The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So building on this idea is we want schools to experience, you know, one of our things that we're pitching is the need for universal school meal programs in all schools. And so this really gives schools an opportunity to see some of the benefits of food in schools. It's essentially a lentil soup, but kids get so excited to eat it. And a lot of kids who wouldn't normally eat soup will eat this soup because their friends are eating it and, you know, there's a bit of an event around it. So it's sort of also for us about creating excitement around local food. So all the ingredients in it are, you know, we get from farmers. And so it really is a uniquely Shuswap soup. And so we provide them the ingredients to make it. And then they get to make it and serve it to the kids, and it's just sort of a fun event.
And some of the supplies also come from local retail sources as well.
Like the lentils are from Fieldstone Organics. Whether Armstrong is in the shoe swap is controversial, I guess.
It's in the shoe swap. Okay. We just declared it in the shoe swap right now.
Okay. But yeah, so yeah, the spirit of it is that, you know, these are ingredients that are been grown by local farmers.
And is it tied in at all to the subsequent Coldest Night of the Year event? Is that kind of a prelude to the Coldest Night of the Year, or is it just fortuitous?
Oh yeah, no, I mean, so soup is kind of symbolic of like warm food, right? And so the Coldest Night we're walking to raise awareness and funds for, you know, the homeless, the hurting, and the hungry. And so, you know, warm soup is a really nourishing food. It's comforting when you're cold. There's lots of ties to the event.
I recall being at a medical conference in Halifax on peace and nuclear weapons and that kind of thing. And at the break, we went out into the community, and there was a public lunch being served. It was soup made out of local wild crafted greens and some regular vegetables from people's gardens, and it was open to everybody. So here were a bunch of doctors bored with a conference on weighty subjects standing around with people who were living rough and people who were passing by, and it was the most delicious soup I've ever tasted in my entire life. I think I probably...
Sounds like it was its own version of stone soup.
It was... I looked for stones and I couldn't find them. Do you ever put a stone in just symbolically to the stone soup, Serena? Is it ever something you want to have as a metaphor for the process?
Oh, yeah. Doing? You need to put the stone in. It doesn't taste as good without the stone. But we will wash it. We will wash it first.
Big stones that won't get confused and swallowed.
But I always say, if you're making it in your Instant Pot, then don't put in a stone.
Yes, you'll probably electrocute yourself or something.
We're offering this to all of our school district 83 schools as an opportunity. We are providing all the ingredients. We provide the recipe, which is the same recipe we'll use for Coldest Night.
Right.
And then it just comes down to which schools would like to participate.
So far, what kind of nibbles are you getting? I mean, it's not
so
that far away.
I think we've got 8 schools participating.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. And they're in Salmon Arm, Enderby,
Armstrong, Sycamose, North Shuswap. Yeah, most of the schools participate. We do have a school in Armstrong participating.
For sure.
But I would say we are more familiar in the Salmon Arm schools right now.
Well, 8 schools is still pretty impressive. And this is the first time this event has taken place?
Second
time. Okay, so you're building on last year's.
Yeah.
Well, that's impressive. On the theme of schools and students. There's another project called Project Grow. Who would like to talk about that? Melanie, why don't you launch?
Yeah, and so this one is still in development. Okay. This is exciting because this was a collaboration that we are being invited to participate in by the Salmon Arm and Shuswap Lake Agricultural Association. So between that organization and the Fall Fair office, they've invited us to participate. And the biggest thing for them is they really want to see kids getting back involved in growing food and submitting that food into the Fall Fair. You know, like it's lessening year after year where people are putting in their produce, and to reinvigorate the desire to be at the fair beyond just the rides and the concessions, we want to stimulate that again with kids. And so this project, that was the idea, and it's being based off a project that's already happening in Summerland. They've been doing it for 25 years with their fair. They invite grade 5 students to grow a garden, and the garden gets judged, and they get a prize and everything like that. So we're modeling it off of that. We're, like I said, it's all just being developed at the moment, so we're not quite ready to launch the project. But we had an hour and a half talk, and the project grew from that idea to something very big that I'm excited about.
Melanie, you just raised an important point or mentioned an important fact, and that is that a school that isn't necessarily in the headlines every day has been doing this particular approach, a very enlightened and progressive approach, for a quarter of a century.
I think that's right.
But even if it's you're off by a couple of years, the idea is clear. And that is that if you look around hard enough and long enough, you'll find examples of wonderful things that have been going on for a long time that we didn't know about because they weren't headline grabbers. But they are the kinds of projects that change the direction of what the community at large is doing in very, very significant ways. It really sounds quite an exciting venture that you guys are on.
Yeah, I'm excited for it and all the ideas that stem from it. We are going to have a display during Heritage Week at the Piccadilly Mall coming up from the 20th to the 25th. So we've just been working together on creating a general display to sort of talk about this project.
Wonderful. I'll just remind listeners that I'm speaking with Melanie Bennett, who's the project coordinator for the Shuswap Food Action Society, and to Serena Kaner, who's the executive director of the same organization. Serena, you're starting to work on a project sometime in April, I understand, with the Métis Association and the Adams Lake First Nation. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, those are actually two different projects. So, So with the Salmon Arm Métis Association, we are organizing a dinner, and it's going to be called Indigenous Foodways. And what we're trying to highlight are some of the cool projects that are happening locally by Indigenous people. So, for example, Lana Payne and Sherelle Anderson have started a group called Rise Up Indigenous Wellness, and they're doing food security projects. So they do cooking, they do food preservation, and they also do emergency food aid. We're going to be having Bonnie from the Shkwekmek hunting camp coming to talk about that project that they do, and that's a youth hunting camp that happens every year. And we're going to have some storytellers. Canton Thomas is going to come and tell us some stories. And so it's just an opportunity to celebrate some of the exciting things that are happening in the Indigenous community in Shkwekmek territory.
Will this project involve just people from the Shkwekmek community, or will it be something that settlers and their descendants could also join in on?
Well, I think priority is going to be given to Indigenous people. We're hosting it on Adams Lake at their log building. And I think that's just, it's still pretty new, this whole process of reconciliation.
Of course.
So it's like, I think a lot of Indigenous people don't actually know about the things that are happening within their own community, right? And so I think I'm going to be there, for example, and I'm non-Indigenous, and I there are going to be people there who are not Indigenous, but our kind of target audience at this stage, I think, is people with
Indigenous connections.
Ancestry. That's right. Yeah, and of course, I think it's not explicitly for, like, we're not going to say you can't get them.
No.
But it is. I think the kind of target audience. We're trying to build relationships, and I think it's going to happen slowly.
Sure.
And I think we need to recognize that that's going to be the natural process. But with Adams Lake Band, they got a grant to do some food security workshops in their community, and this is about sharing knowledge on how to, you know, process and preserve traditional foods.
So this will involve some wildcrafted foods. This will involve foraged foods as well.
Yeah, I mean we're still in the process of, but we're, you know, there'll be something like, there'll be one on, you know, pressure canning salmon, and there'll be one on making jerky, and one on canning, and one on you know, preserving wild meat, and so yes. And the idea is that community members are going to be the main leaders of this. And with it, they're also purchasing, as a community, they're purchasing equipment so that, you know, these types of skills and workshops can continue into the future.
I had a long conversation at a year or two ago with one of the Shkrumpik elders here in the Thomas family about cooking meat in the ground, something that has been done for thousands of years and all around the world in many cultures. And it was a fascinating conversation because it was detailed. She was explaining that you do certain things and you don't do certain other things, because if you do that right, you get this wonderful result. And if you don't do it right, you know, things go awry. Will there be those kinds of cooking methods and approaches as part of what this event will involve?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that we have discussed cooking in the ground. That would be an interesting, thing to bring up. I'm trying to be more of a listener than a director in this role. So I'm trying to sort of play off what the community wants and not what I think they should do.
which is very much the way we should be doing things these days. The activation of respect is more than just a lot of words. It's also our behavior, and our behavior has to be focused around that approach to a lot of learning that is really quite powerful and quite influential. And if we were able to absorb it and listen to it and then participate in it as respectful participants, I think it would go a long way to making things in our world a lot better. Now, on the theme of education, there's also adult education programs, and Buckerfields has a meeting room that has been occupied by a number of speakers that the Food Action Society has coordinated. Melanie, maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm still so pleased that we get to keep going with these Sunday sessions for self-sufficiency.
That's a lot of S's right there.
Yeah, I know it is. It's good alliteration. So we break it down to just Sunday sessions. And we've had excellent speakers, and they are all so willing to give their time and knowledge to whoever would like to come and listen. It has been growing since it's first started in November, and we've had a session every Sunday, and we continue, all, you know, February is booked, and we already have plans for March. I hope it goes all the way into April until we can maybe get on site into gardens to do some workshops as well.
So the indoor presentations are a counterpoint to the out in the fresh air events that take place at the garden and in other settings.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that will be the goal. The nice thing, though, too, is that, you know, if we get scorching hot temperatures in the summer, or if we get smoke again, you know, we still always have that room. Toni Walton, manager of Buckerfields here, she's very passionate about this subject matter, too. And so she wants people to learn this content. And so she's very willing to have that room upstairs be used to teach.
So if somebody was going for the first time to one of these gatherings, when and exactly where in the building do they go?
So their conference room is upstairs. So you head to the back, go up the stairs, and it's It's a big room. It's a long, narrow room. We've got the chairs and everything. If a presenter has a presentation, they can use a screen. Most often, everyone's talking. Sometimes display. We actually did a fermentation workshop. We had basics of sourdough. And then this past week, we had, how to eat your greens and be healthy. And so our speaker, Juanita, she brought her tower garden. And on Sunday, we're going to be teaching about how to make your own maple syrup. So we'll get to see all the equipment required to tap maple trees. And it's
I'm starting to get hungry. I just want you to know. Sorry.
Yes.
And the timing of it?
Yeah, it's almost always between 2 and 3. That's what we aim for. So all of this information is on our website. It's under shushwapfood.ca /Sunday-sessions. So people can see the calendar. And then they also now we are recording them. And so we're putting those up on our website too, so that people, if they weren't able to make it, they can still learn the information.
And these are video recordings, so people can see what Videos. Actually is going on.
Yeah. I want to thank Dwayne and Michael for providing those files to us so far.
And they will be on your website as well?
That's they are on the website.
Okay, that's good. Now, another, of course, site of teaching is the Teaching Garden. And it's shaping up to be another active year in the garden.
Yeah.
One new project that's added in will be coordinated by Patty Thurston from the Shushwap Family Center, called around the what she calls a youth entrepreneurial program. Can you just get a little bit of an idea of what that's all about?
Honestly, it's really new. She and I just spoke about it. I don't have a lot of information, but what we did say is that we really, the Community Teaching Garden was created by the Family Center with the concept that they wanted to have their clients be able to learn how to grow food, learn how to harvest it, and then take it back to their kitchen and learn how to cook and preserve. So that's the concept behind that garden. And we've taken a big role in it in the last 4 years and continuing on. So I'm really happy to have some of their staff coming back and using that garden space as a learning opportunity for any of their clients.
What's the scope and extent of the garden going to be this growing season? Every year it's a little different. You've got new things happening all the time. What's going to be happening there?
This year, last year we doubled our production of food, and that was because we had our garden mentor, Sue Moore, and she's been on the radio station here as well. So, with her experience as a farmer, she really helped us to maximize our production. And so we were able to grow over 3,000 pounds of food. That's what we've tallied. So between, extra production and being more efficient with that space, we also have created a permaculture display garden because of an excellent volunteer named Elle Marie, who's found us, thankfully, and we've given her a lot of freedom to basically transform a big weedy scrub into a very productive garden. And we're going to grow that this year more too.
I'm just going to say one word on behalf of that weedy scrub. I like to call them energetic local perennials who are very well adapted. I say who, they have a little personality, all of them, who are adapted to the ecosystem that we live in, and they grow really well. And if we could learn ways... If we could lay ways to harvest them and use them, we'd probably be doing very well.
They are resilient, that's for sure.
That's right. So, Serena, maybe you could talk about the expanding scope of engagement with the formal education system, because that's something that's been part of what the Food Action Society has been doing for a long time. Maybe just kind of reflect on that a little bit and share with listeners what you see happening both now and in the future in the formal education system itself?
Well, I've been sort of working informally with the education system for, 5 or 6 years now. And one thing I've observed is that school systems are at their max. They're at their capacity. And teachers are reluctant to take on anymore because they're already feeling too much. And so if we want food education to happen in schools, because right now it only happens if teachers want it to, right? So they don't have to do anything. I mean, they have content they're supposed to cover, but it's not tested, it's not measured, it's not, you know, no one's districts aren't checking to see whether or not kids can cook an egg or not. So if it's going to happen, you know, it needs some support. At this stage, it needs support from the outside world. And I think that's where we see us playing a role. So is that we are going to try and facilitate food literacy in schools. And so we do that through, you know, school-based school meal programs. So, you know, just by cooking food in a school, you're teaching and serving healthy food in schools, you're teaching food literacy.
And they can smell the food too.
They can smell the food, you know. There's, you know, Melanie's been doing a lot of cool things with, you know, food preservation and class and, you know, individual classes. You know, we had Kindy Buddies, which was a cooking program with seniors in school. So I guess, yeah, we're trying to reduce the barriers of food literacy in schools and to kind of pique teacher curiosity so that they decide to want to do this in their classroom.
I'm just going to remind listeners again that you're listening to our guest today, Melanie Bennett, who is the project coordinator for the Shuswap Food Action Society, and Serena Kaner, who is the executive director. I'm really pleased to see you haven't adopted the commercial term of CEO and your executive director, because that has a long and honorable history in the nonprofit community. And congratulations to you for that small gesture. Serena, I want to pose a question to you about what you were saying about the education system being kind of maxed out. And that is that I wonder if you're also dealing with sort of a conceptual framework for education. Read and write and arithmetic has been considered the basis of the education system, and yet those are not manual skills. Those are not skills that involve three-dimensional reality. They're stuff you do on a piece of paper. Are you, in some respect, bringing the idea that learning how to do things with your hands, do things that involve a lot of intellectual content, but are fundamentally, you know, kind of like shop, as they call it in the education system, you know, guys, young men learning how to repair a car or build a building. And you're talking about skills that are actually more commonly associated with the conventional role of women in society, but also are very manual. Is there a kind of a conceptual gap between what you're trying to bring to the education system and the way the education system has traditionally or conventionally worked in this part of the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of changes in the role of, you know, in society, I should say, and the role that, you know, education plays. So one of the barriers I'm coming up against is the societal assumption that it's the parents' responsibility to feed their child. So, you know, a lot of what I'm working against is this people not acknowledging that schools need to have food right now. There is so much food insecurity in our community, and every single school in our district has children hungry at school. And this isn't something that they have accepted. And they don't see it as their responsibility. So I think from their perspective, if they can hand out a granola bar, you know, then they're serving their purpose. And I guess what I'm saying is, you know, a granola bar is not a meal. You know, you're not teaching kids how to learn to eat. And it's not going to make them, you know, it's not setting them up for success in life or in school.
And they're going to have a heck of a time finding out what's actually in the granola bar and where it came from. Whereas if it's local and they knew it, put it on the plate.
Yeah, don't get me started on granola bars or you'll...
All right. We'll ban the subject. Melanie, why don't you offer your perspective on this whole area?
Yeah, I'd like to highlight the fact that this fundraiser that we're doing now, Coldest Night, has allowed us to grow substantially in the last 2 years. You know, we, like Serena mentioned, the Kindy Buddies program. So Serena created that in 2018. We were able to do it as a pilot at South Canoe Outdoor School for 2019, and it was really successful. Because of COVID, schools got shut down, and so we were kind of put on stall for any of the educational components of our goals and visions of this society. So what's exciting is that, you know, everybody is open to the idea now of getting back to let's teach these skills. And these skills are so important. I mean, learning your nutrition, learning where food comes from, these are important life skills. And if we want a healthy society and these kids to grow up knowing how to nourish their bodies so that they can avoid chronic illness, to take, you know, take a little bit of the pressure off of our medical system, all of that actually stimulates the economy. You know, like, it's all good. So these are important skills.
I'm often struck by the fact that a lot of the learning that goes on in formal education is on paper, and it doesn't involve combining the intellectual content of motor activity, if you want to say building something or cooking something, with the fact that there is an enormous amount of intellectual content in those activities. They are based on profoundly important scientific principles around biological activities and interactions. And yet they're sometimes considered to be just kind of something you do without any mental content going along with it. Melanie, what do you think about that way of looking at the world and how out of date it really is?
I think our biology means that you learn best when you actually have a physical component to your learning. Rote arithmetic and rote writing. You know, you can memorize things. I did great in school because I studied right before the test. You can memorize anything and put words down on paper, but to actually truly have it become a skill, something that you can do and teach others, the best way to actually learn something is to teach it. And that's because there's a mechanical component, like what you're saying. You are learning how to cook something, and your brain creates the synapses to actually make it a memory, a true memory.
Serena, do you want to jump in here? Because I think you probably could.
Yeah. Well, and I just want to mention one more thing that we run up against a lot, and that is this idea, like we're doing a soup program, and we also are doing this school meal program that the food is offered to everyone. And I have a lot of parents tell me, oh, my kid doesn't like soup. And this drives me crazy because, you know, eating is a learned behavior. You can learn to like anything. I was in Malawi and kids eat insects there, and you would think they were M&Ms. Like, they're just so happy to eat them because they've learned that this is a food that's healthy, that you should celebrate, and that it's good for you. And I think, you know, when parents say that to me, what you're like, kids can learn to like soup, and learning to like food or learning to eat food that you don't like is actually a really important social skill, because every child and every person is going to be in a situation where they have to eat food that they don't like, and you know, that's part of life. And you know, learning to nourish your body, you have to learn to like, you know, some different foods. And you can't nourish a body only eating, you know, Mr. Noodles and Kraft Dinner your whole childhood.
And the planet is changing under our influence. And we have to acknowledge the fact that that is making this more than just a theoretical argument. This is something that has very practical implications, both in the short and the long term. So I think it's time for us to launch into the subject that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, and that is the coldest night of the year event. I'll just give a little bit of background and we can sort of launch into the logistics of what's going on. It's an initiative of the Blue Sea Foundation, which is based in Ontario, and its tagline is Helping Charities Thrive. That's the foundation's tagline. In other words, they're an organization that's trying to make it so that there's a little democracy in the nonprofit world. And I'll give you an idea why that's important. There are approximately 170,000 charitable and nonprofit organizations in Canada, and out of these, about 85,000 are registered charities. That means they can hand you a tax receipt that you can take off your income tax. In the last few years, about 10 of the largest charities got about 10% of the, sorry, 10 individual charities got about 10% of the charitable giving from all Canadians. That's 10 out of 85,000 got, you know, a 10%. And out of the total of all the organizations, 100 of them, the largest ones, received a third of all charitable donations. So that means there are thousands and thousands of small organizations like the Shuswap Food Action Society, that are kind of being, I wouldn't say starved out, but certainly overwhelmed at times by the power of the larger nonprofit organizations to garner funds from the public. So the Blue Sea Foundation is trying to provide partners, its nonprofit organization partners, with an opportunity to give their constituents a significant, satisfying, and I'm reading off their website, and even fun engagement around a particular cause. And they make this very important distinction that while they work on a national scale or scope, everything they do is, as they describe it, intensely local in execution. In other words, they do background work, and they do a lot of that. They do the administrative stuff. When I was having a conversation with Melody before the show, she said, all that admin stuff, the admin stuff that drives you crazy, you know, filling in the right space on a form or making sure that the numbers all add up. But Blue Sea Foundation works hard to make sure that organizations and their participants and donors put their emotional investment into the event that they are participating in with their local partner charity, in this case, the Shuswap Food Action Society. They have two other kinds of projects. They have what they call the Ride for Refuge, which is sort of a bicycle event around finding funds for displaced, vulnerable, and exploited persons. They have a grand parade event or series of events. The first, the Ride for Refuge, is in the beginning of October. The grand parade is focused around support services for the elderly and takes place in mid-September. And then, on a grand scale, there is the Coldest Night of the Year project event, etc., which is designed, as Serena said earlier, for helping people who are experiencing hurt, hunger, and homelessness, all of which I think everyone in this community would agree are laudable goals. Now, the Shuswap Food Action Society's engagement with the Coldest Night of the Year was a little bit accidental. Melanie, tell me about Mika and Justin, the Mika and Justin saga. It's small, but it's important.
Well, you know, back in, it would have been 2019, actually, we were offered the Coldest Night of the Year fundraiser. And we were offered it because we became a charity, because that's one of the criteria. And we, you know, we do fit the criteria as far as helping with food insecurity. And so basically it came to us because the previous, you know, participants of the Coldest Night of the Year just could not do it that year. And so it came to us. Justin happened to know the fellow Mika, who used to live here in Salmon Arm. And I'm sorry, I can't remember his last name or pronounce it, actually. He lived here for a long time as a child, and he loved Salmon Arm, and he was sort of looking for a different charity to do this. And it just happened to come to us. And we've said this in a previous interview too. It was good luck. All the timing was just right. The fact that, you know, the pandemic started, which really highlighted, the food systems, and that it came to us and that we were a charity. It was just all really excellent timing.
So I'm just putting a little plug, Melanie, for serendipity, one of the organizing principles of life, because it's one of my favorite topics, how things happen. And as they say, success is dependent on a prepared mind. And if somebody's already thinking about something and then the little serendipitous event takes place, sparks fly, events take place, people move forward. Yeah. And that's what you're just describing in spades.
And it's been incredible. You know, the first year, the response was overwhelming. We had a goal of $40,000 and we raised 60. And that was on the principle of food security. So obviously it really hit home with so many people and they really rallied around this. I mean, we were already working on projects, but not to the scale that we are now. And so between that year and the following year, with the fundraising, we've really substantially grown and the momentum is building in a exciting and slightly overwhelming way, but we're passionate about this. And so we're excited to do the work, and we are community supported and community funded at this point in time.
Just as a matter of interest, the Coldest Night of the Year event generally speaking, has also expanded. In 2011, there were only two locations where a Coldest Night of the Year event was taking place. Now there are 182. And of those, 34 are in British Columbia alone. So there's an expansion of interest and motivation to participate in community building operations. And by being part of this, you're in the forefront of that process.
Yeah, it's a big event.
Now, the Blue Sea Foundation does, you know, looks after the finances, the receipting, does training. They also do a lot of training for you guys. They support you in all aspects of developing this event. Serena, what's it like to have an organization based in Ontario have such a sensitive and important role in a project like this in Salmon Arm?
Well, like Mel said, that the leader was actually from Salmon Arm originally, so I think we kind of feel connected to him in that way. You know, Melanie has to take the credit for the success of Coldest Night over over myself, because, you know, she is critical to the organization of the event, and she is the detail. You know, one of my many faults is I have a different perspective of detail than a lot of, you know, conventional society.
Like, detail will take care of itself if Melanie's there.
Yeah. So I, you know, I think Melanie would probably be a better person to ask that question too.
Yeah, well, I mean, Serena, it's not a fault because you have all kinds of other benefits. No, I mean, it's been great. They've been super supportive. I would not have been able to do this without the support they've given. And at this point, too, we have a big team. I mean, last year, I really underestimated how many volunteers were needed. And all of a sudden, at the kind of like the 11th hour, all of these volunteers kind of came to our aid. So last year was successful because we had a lot more help. And then this year, too, you know, more volunteers. We've got our board members who are all, you know, play a role. So it is a team effort. There are a lot of details to planning an event and, you know, finding all of our amazing sponsors for the event too. Like, we have so many business sponsors and goods and service sponsors, and then connecting with the various organizations and teams and people to walk. I mean, we're at 177 walkers as of today. We have raised 45% of our goal. Our goal this year is $70,000. And yeah, so we've raised almost $32,000 so far. And we have 15 days to go. 15 busy days. And we're going to be issuing some challenges soon, too, to some of our teams. Because the tagline is, and it's very important to say, while the cause is serious, the event is fun.
That's probably not a bad tagline. Perhaps I can just offer some statistics about Coldest Night of the Year on a national scale, because it really is a substantive project. Last year, there were 5,078 teams of participants. There were 22,929 walkers. There were 3,417 volunteers. There were 50,236 donors, individual donors, people who donated money to the project. As I mentioned earlier, 182 locations around the country. Sponsors were 1,643 organizations and entities in various communities. The money raised was substantial, and it is in the tens of millions of dollars. I don't have the actual number here, but it really is substantial. So, Melanie, this is something that seemed to appeal to communities and touch a nerve in people's lives.
Well, what I love about this project, this event, is that it's fully inclusive. The event used to actually have a registration fee. And with that registration fee, you also received the sort of iconic toque. Listeners can't see, but I am wearing my Coldest Night of the Year toque this today.
Very fetching, Melanie.
Thank
Very
you.
Fetching.
I love this year's is quite attractive. And so by removing the registration fee, though, it also reduced any barrier to somebody wanting to participate. So there are multiple ways to participate. You can walk. You can walk in person with us, or even if you lived somewhere else, you could walk in spirit with us. Of course, you can donate, and what we like to say is, you know, take a look at our list of walkers and see. So for adults, they do need to, in order to be gifted the toque, they do need to raise $150. And so, and for youth, which you wouldn't know who a youth is on the walker list, but youth need to raise $75. And so we say, if you'd like to gift somebody, especially for Valentine's Day, let's say, you could choose a walker who has not raised $150 and donate to them. Anything over $20 does receive a charitable tax receipt, and all the money goes to the same place. So it doesn't really matter who you donate to, even if it's your favorite friend. There's some people who have raised over $1,000 individually. Fundraising is not always fun for people. And so you can self-donate. I did that to myself this year. And you can also just walk. You don't even have to fundraise. You can participate as you are, just to build that community spirit.
As you're describing this, I have the picture of stories emerging, people doing things that sort of touch your heart, things where somebody was generous, somebody was turned on by this notion of communities coming together. Have you had people come up to you and say, gosh, this was really something that turned my crank, made me really feel glad to be part of a community like this and a community event?
Yeah, well, we did ask for testimonials last year, of course, and we did receive a number of them. Actually, one of them is on our social media by actually one of the founders of the Food Conversations, Shelley Corbin. She wrote a beautiful testimonial just about how pleased she is to be in such a generous community. And, you know, I hear this over and over again, too. This community is taking really good care of each other. We are, you know, we're all very aware of trying to shop local. We have very, very generous businesses who donate to a lot of different kinds of causes. So we're fortunate here. We're taking care of each other.
Although a portion of the money raised goes to the Blue Sea Foundation, they really give value for that money. They do the financial work, you know, all the paperwork. They do a lot of marketing on a broader scale. You do a lot of the local marketing, but they have a website that's very easy to navigate. Once you're on it, you can find Sam and Aram in a jiffy and find ways to participate, as well as presumably through your website as well. Do you also have links there? Melanie?
We do have a link to Coldest Night of the Year, yes.
Okay, that's important for listeners to know about. Let's once again go over the time, date, place, logistics, what you do, what you get, etc. Melanie, I'll give you once again, and then I'll get Serena to tell us the secret ingredients in the soup. So Melanie, do the logistics for us.
Okay. So you can learn all about the event and about the Food Action Society at the website, which is CNOY, so the, you know, abbreviation for Coldest Night of the Year, but CNOY.org/Sam and Arm. It will take you to the page and it shows you all the event details. It tells you the walkers, it tells you our sponsors, and it tells you the details of the event. It is Saturday, February 25th. We meet up at downtown Saskatoon between 4 and 5 for check-in, and we have our brief opening ceremonies. There we will have cookies and we'll have hot chocolate. I've got some face painting this year so that we can really mark ourselves well. And, you know, everybody will be there with various toques, whether it's this year or previous years or just their own. And we get together, we do our walk, 2 or 5 kilometer walks, and we stop at Salvation Army, which is where we do our Lighthouse Food Forest collaboration. We have Little Red Hen Bakery treats, and we're going to have some Anactus apple cider. And then we head down to downtown Askew's, and we will have our stone soup with inspired bread buns, so, you know, organic buns. And we're going to have some coffee and treats, and I'm hoping for some music. And yeah, it's a good time. It's for everyone. It's family friendly. We really encourage kids because children do need to understand the topics, the subject matter. They need to understand that they are part of a community and they will become community members and volunteers in the future. So it is inclusive. Everyone can participate, though you do need to register because it actually does have like liability insurance.
Yes, I suppose everybody these days has liability insurance for just about everything. I once again remind listeners, I'm talking with Melanie Bennett and Serena Kaner from the Shushrot Food Action Society. Serena, Melanie was talking about engagement and involvement on an individual level. When we were talking before the show, she pointed out that there is a trend towards the Food Action Society becoming a bit of a hub, a bit of an umbrella organization, if you like. There's something about what you're doing that is bringing in and building out connections with other organizations and other processes in the community. Do you want to talk about that a little bit and what it's like to see this happening all around you?
Sure. Yeah, I think the issue of food resonates with everybody because everybody has to eat. And food is, you know, really a source of joy. I mean, or it should be, it, you know, for most people, you know, eating is something that brings you pleasure every day. And so it's also necessary for health. And it's actually a human right that we actually all have the right to food. And I think that's, you know, one thing that we need to reflect on is that in our society today, your diet really reflects your economics more than anything else. So what you eat often is what you can afford to eat. And that's, you know, based on a long history of, you know, colonialism and slavery, and, you know, you could go on about why food is the way it is today. But what we have, all the other power of food is that it is a way of bringing people together. And I think it's very collaborative in that way. And so this work becomes very collaborative. And we like to think of ourselves as a collaborative organization. So we've had a lot of the other organizations reaching out to us, you know, with ideas that we can, you know, that they want to help us with or partner with us. And I think that's what's really exciting about this work is that, you know, it's really helping to build community because, like, in the last 2 years, the amount of people that I know in Salmon Arm has like increased exponentially. and it's like knowing your community is a really important thing, especially, you know, moving into the future that we are moving towards.
Do you sense that there's two factors that are operating in the background for all of us? One is the recent memories from the pandemic, COVID-19, and the other is the growing awareness and the growing impact of the climate crisis, which is starting to induce all sorts of new insights and changes in behavior broadly in the community, but also in larger organizations and governing structures. So because the Shushrot Food Action Society is seeming to engender this kind of some new responses that are more community focused and collaborative, do you sense that there are influences from these two events, the recent pandemic and then the more existentially threatening climate warming process, that have had an influence on this process?
Well, if they aren't having an influence on you, then something is wrong.
You could be brain dead.
Then I think that has a large part to do with it. Is it, you know, it's very clear that food and water are going to be real issues in every community across the globe, and already are. But, you know, I think we've been sheltered because this land was discovered later in the, you know, process of by, you know, colonizers. You know, we have a bit more resources than a lot of other parts of the world. But it is becoming clear that, you know, these are, you can't really deny you can't deny that climate change is happening, and you can't deny that there are going to be food shortages. I think that it is more relevant. Everyone has seen empty grocery stores. You know, people have experienced, you know, flooding. They've seen videos of like really destroyed farmland, and they, you know, so it's becoming harder to ignore the problem.
Melanie, we're just coming to the end of the show. You have any final comments on this topic? Because it, I think it's an important one.
Yes, I certainly do. The main point that we always want to strive is this, is that we live in an amazing place in the Shuswap. We're very fortunate to be here with our growing season, that we can grow food, that we have incredible farmers here who are trying to regenerate our land. We have beautiful soil, we have water. So we are so lucky. And to squander it, to not do our part to take care of ourselves would be a real sad thing. That we can do this. It's good for our health. It's good for our mental health. It's good for our community. It's good for the environment. And so we are here as an organization to help people learn how to grow more of their own food, why they could, you know, what benefits it has. And we want to help people do this. So we can do this, especially as a community.
There's no better way to end the show than comments like that. Thank you very much, Melanie Bennett and Serena Kaner. It's been a wonderful time hanging out with you again on the radio and hearing your inspiring comments on what's going on the committee, and especially the coldest night of the year. Thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Thank you.